This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello and welcome to The Twilight Show. Thanks for joining me. Today, my special guest is Gabriela Madera from Argentina, and we will be talking about why sustainability is important in education.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Twilight Show, everyone. I'm Graham Stanley, speaking to you live from Mexico City. As I mentioned earlier on today's show, I'll be talking to Gabriela Madera from Argentina about her work, looking particularly at the Sustainable Development Goals and sustainability in general in education. Gabriela Madera is a teacher and an educator based in Buenos Aires with over 30 years of experience. She's managed the English department of a primary bilingual school, and she's also led curriculum development and remote teaching initiatives. She holds various degrees in education from different institutions, specializing in English language teaching, remote teaching, school management, and sustainable education. And I'll be talking to Gabby about sustainability and more after the Teachers Talk Radio news.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reported on a long-term study by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which found children living near Sure Start centres did better at GCSE. The research says these living near a centre performed up to 3 grades better than those living further away. Sure Start began in 1998 to support new parents, especially in disadvantaged areas, but due to austerity, many have since closed. The Department for Education said its Family Hub scheme had a number of advantages over the Sure Start model. The IFS study used postcodes from when children were age 5 to determine proximity to centres and looked at the GCSE results of those children 11 years later. It found what it describes as big improvements in performance in those living near a centre, especially those from low-income backgrounds. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Labour Chancellor at the time the initiative was launched, said the UK now needs a new Sure Start, and described the results as what most parents already know, that a supportive environment in early years was life-transforming. Among all children in the study, those who live near a Sure Start centre performed better than those who lived far away. But the trend was most pronounced amongst those eligible for free school meals and those from minority ethnic backgrounds. According to The Guardian, schools in England could lose up to £1 billion in funding by 2030, with exceptional falls in pupil numbers prompting closures. Mergers and school closures are already happening in parts of London, where pupil numbers have been falling for some time. According to the think tank Education Policy Institute, the North East is projected to see the greatest decline in primary pupil numbers, down by 13% by 2028 to 29. At secondary school level, Yorkshire and Humber, the North East and London are projected to have the largest falls in pupil numbers, although other areas, including the West Midlands and the South East, have rising numbers. Pupil numbers had grown because of a fertility surge in the 2000s, but as that cohort has moved through, numbers are now falling. Even with increases in per pupil funding, the EPI predicts schools will find it hard to balance budgets as fewer pupils do not lead to reduced costs. The decline is due mainly to a falling birth rate and changing migration patterns. Full details of the EPI projections can be found on the Guardian website. Schools Week reports on the decision by Ofsted to appoint a former chief inspector, Dame Christine Gilbert, to lead the independent inquiry into its response to the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine served as the HMCI from 2006 to 2011 and now chairs the Education Endowment Foundation. The learning review follows a coroner's ruling in December that an Ofsted inspection contributed to the death of Mrs. Perry, then head teacher of Caversham Primary School. The review will consider actions Ofsted took in response to hearing about the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine will have access to relevant records, Ofsted staff, and the opportunity to meet with Ruth Perry's family as part of the review. The review will not examine the November 2022 inspection of Caversham Primary. Teaching unions have expressed concern about the appointment of Gilbert, saying it was critical that the review was robust, independent and impartial, and that some would, rightly, question the notion of a former HMCI reviewing the work of Ofsted. A report will be completed after the review and recommendations will focus on future actions. Schools Week also reports on a plan for the Department for Education to work with the Scout Association to provide 40,000 explorers, those aged 14 to 18, with the skills and knowledge they need to consider a career in teaching. The DfE will work with the Scouts to create age-appropriate activities that inspire young people to consider a career in teaching, linking to relevant badges and awards. It did, however, clarify that there are currently no plans for a teaching badge. The policy is part of the DfE's Get Into Teaching plan, which aims to elevate the status of the profession and target new audiences who have not yet considered teaching as a career. The scheme will launch in September and it is hoped that it will reach 40,000 young people. The Scouts will create support and guidance material for those running the programme. The initial one-year contract is worth £43,000, but can be extended subject to budget availability. Finally, a teenager who campaigned for skateboarding to be included in school qualifications is proud to see it added to the list of approved GCSE sports in Wales. According to the report on the BBC News website, Qualifications Wales has added 13 new sports to the approved list for GCSE PE. Other newly allowed sports include BMX, shooting, kickboxing and wakeboarding. The new Made for Wales GCSE in Physical Education and Health will be available for first teaching from September 2026. The change makes Wales the second UK nation to include skateboarding, behind Northern Ireland. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
So welcome back, everyone, and a welcome in particular to my special guest, Gabriela Madeira. Gabby, thank you so much for joining me. What have you been up to lately?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Graham. It's great to be here with you. I'm very grateful for the invitation and I'm very looking forward to talking to all the audience of followers that you've got. Okay, I've been working as usual and studying and working and doing my stuff as a teacher And I'd like to share that with you. So whatever you'd like to know about me, just shoot.
Of course. So you said you've been studying. What are you studying at the moment?
I'm always studying. That's my, you know, it's like I've been crazy all my life about studying different things, you know. So I totally believe in CPD and professional development nonstop. So that's why I did so many things. I guess there's something, even though you and I know each other and have known each other for a long time now, I guess there's something you've never heard of. So I'm willing to tell you that before becoming an educator, I was an actress. Did you know that?
I don't think I did. Oh, really? Yeah. So when did this all start?
Okay, I never told you this. The thing is that when I was in secondary school, I loved studying. I was a very good student at school, and but I loved drama. I loved drama, okay. And I really wanted to become an actress, which was a problem at home, you know, and also at school, because the heads of the school couldn't believe that I wouldn't do anything, you know, more academic. So when I decided to get into the school of drama, my parents were in Europe on a trip, and I had to send them a letter because I wouldn't have the cheek to tell them that I was going to do that, you know?
Oh, really? So, and how did they react?
They reacted to it. As you can imagine, my father, that I'm talking about the 80s.
Yeah.
And my father was like, "What? Are you crazy? That's not something for you. You're so good at maths and this and that, you know?" So what he did was he waited. He allowed me to do that, but he waited for a couple of years until I was in, let's say, third year of the drama school, which took 5 years. And he sent me to the UK, you know? He was brilliant because he sent me there. He put my name down in a school of English. And I had already been studying here and I had an advanced level. So he sent me to Oxford, which I, you know, I'm always so thankful to my dad for having done that, because number one, because I loved the UK. I loved the host family. I'm still in touch with them thanks to Facebook, let's say. And I studied a lot there for a whole season. And then when I came back, I said, well, this is my source of income, you know?
Yeah.
So I just looked for a job as a teacher, and I was given a job through the BBC. It was a, I don't know if it exists here, but in those days we had a sort of institution called the BBC London that took on teachers to send to companies, you know? So I was sent to companies, and obviously—
This is in Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires, yes.
Yeah.
And obviously, Graham, as soon as I started teaching, I noticed I didn't know enough, you know? It was like, what am I doing? I should study this in depth, you know? So I put my name down at the teacher training college, and then I dropped drama, and well, I became a teacher, and that's my whole life now. I've always liked being a teacher. So this is my favorite game from when I was a little girl. So it was a dream come true, you know. And from then on, it was one thing after the other one at universities and institutions and studying different stuff. And
So, Gabby, you were still studying drama when you when this all happened, when you sort of changed to become a teacher, did you?
Exactly, yes. I became a teacher in the last 2 years, let's say, of my drama school, but at the same time I was acting at the theater. I did some small things on TV as well. And then of course I became fascinated by the world of teaching English and all the things, the possibilities it opened up for me, and obviously also because it was a steady source of income, whereas when you do drama, it's full of ups and downs, and I'm not particularly fond of that instability. You know? So that's
and do you ever
yes
do you ever regret, Gabby, not continuing with the drama, or did you continue with it part-time as well?
No, I never regretted that, because really I did my my best to be the best actress possible. When I was doing that, as usual, I'm always doing my best at everything I undertake. And then when it was over, I just plunged myself into education, and that's what I've done. And I think I've done pretty well. I don't know. I worked for you with you as well, so you can tell better than me.
I think you've done more than pretty well. And and so I'd love to hear a little bit more about what happened then. So apart from teaching,
I'll tell you everything, because there are some funny things to share with you as well. For instance, would you ever imagine that I once worked for the FBI, Graham?
No, you're joking. Are you allowed to say that?
I did, yes.
How did you get involved with the FBI?
Okay, I was working at the School of Police here in Buenos Aires, because I was that was one of the teachers of history, I guess, at the Joaquín B. González, which is a teacher training college I graduated from. He sort of gathered a group of, you know, the best average teachers in the teacher training college, and I was part of that. So he called me and he said, well, we are sort of having a kind of, well, I'm blushing when I say this, but a kind of elite group of teachers, that's what he said. And one of them, would you be interested in teaching at the School of Police? And I said, yes, of course, obviously. I always say yes, you know, that's my problem. So when it comes to working, of course. And he took me there. And the thing is that between the teacher training college, my graduation, and that job, I had done 3 years for this course called interpretation. That was called simultaneous and something else. I'm not so sure about the name because it has changed. But it was an institution that it wasn't official. But I got the degree and I finished the course, and I was and I had written that in my CV, you know. So the head of the police school saw my CV, and he had this brilliant idea of interrupting one of my classes without letting me know anything in advance. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, come with us, because there's a group of people from the Caribbean. It's called the Caribbean Chapter for International Terrorism. Imagine that. And he just pushed me there in the middle of an ordinary school day, let's say. And I had to do that by myself, which is very hard, because that's a job that requires at least, you know, a break after 20 minutes, because your brain is really exhausted after you know, so much work, without any material beforehand. So I was just doing my best there. I did that for 3 days in a row, and it was so exhausting and so, you know, stressful that I said, no, this is not for me. So that was the only time I worked as an interpreter live, let's say. And well, that's how I ended up working for them. And I've got some souvenirs from the FBI at home.
So they you interpreted for the FBI then?
I did, and it was really hard, because they were sharing news about the latest attacks with bombs and, you know, casualties and things that was, you know, I was really shocked by the content of what I had to speak about. I wasn't ready for that, and I didn't really enjoy it, although I did it, and okay, they were happy with me, but I was not happy at all with that experience.
I can imagine.
Well, that was the only time I did something so weird, let's say. but well, then after that, I decided to continue my education as a teacher, and I went into different courses. If you want, I can tell you about that, but it's a little bit too much, perhaps.
Well, just the bigger picture would be interesting to hear, because you you obviously were not sort of content with just teaching. You were looking for other things to do, teacher development, teacher education, and then management as well. I'd like to know kind of ended up moving into that area, those areas of education.
All right. Well, I was a teacher at the primary school where I've worked mm-hmm. for many, many years. And I've always done different things there, but always as a teacher. And at one point I said, well, if I want to move forward with this, I need to do something else. So I started studying at Universidad de Buenos Aires, the prestigious university, public university mm-hmm. here in Argentina. And I took a course on a postgraduate course on reading strategies for, you know, international students. It took 2 years. And then after that, I said, well, this is great, but I need more. So I got into Universidad de Quilmes, which is another public institution here. And I did what we call here licenciatura en educación. I guess there's no equivalent in English.
It's similar to a degree. Is that right?
Legal education, that's what I said, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I finished that at school, there was a sort of need for some help in the management board, you know. So I was appointed deputy head. Mm-hmm. Apparently I did well. So after some years, they said, okay, we need you to be the head of English. I mean, mm-hmm. just move forward like a promotion, you know. So I said, okay, well, all right, yes, I'm ready for that. And when I was doing that, I said, well, now I need to study something connected with management, you know, because even though you can do that just following your intuition, you really need to have, you know, all the knowledge and the background that you need to do your job well. So I got into this management sort of, we call it gestión, diplomatura en gestión, that is the a kind mm-hmm. of a degree in management, school management, and I did that as well. So, you know, I never stop. And now that I have just left this management at school, I have more free time, although I go on teaching and doing other kinds of things connected with education. But I started focusing more on literature and things that I had left behind, basically due to lack of time. And that's it. But also, you know, what I did about remote teaching, which is another passion of mine, because it's somehow
yeah. But before we move on to that, I'd love to, what would you suggest to any teachers who are interested in maybe doing something similar to in moving into school leadership, school management?
Okay.
Is the key to actually study and get qualifications, or are there other steps that you haven't yet told us about?
Okay, that's a very good question, I guess, because of course, I believe that whatever you do in life, you have to be very well prepared for that. And mm-hmm. It's not just a question of being a natural leader, which you have to be, because obviously you need to tackle lots of different problems. So you need to enjoy what you do. You need to have the, you know, sensitivity to perceive, for instance, teachers' needs. That's crucial. Mm-hmm. But also have some kind of, you know, emotional stability, I would say, to deal with parents, because that's a tough part when you're the head of a school.
Right.
Especially in primary school, you know. And also to sort of be the sort of go between the board of the school and the teachers' needs and the community needs. Because, for instance, when we had the pandemic, Graham, I can tell you it was the hardest time ever in my professional life. And thankfully, I had the experience with remote teaching before. So overnight, I was responsible for moving the whole school with 700 students and lots of teachers from face-to-face classes to the virtual environment. So it was really very hard, and you cannot, being a leader, you cannot just give up, you see. You cannot just, you know, take some time to rest or say, well, I'll stay home and take my time to catch up. No, no, you have to be there 24/7, you know, especially in a context of the pandemic. So I would say that teachers who are looking forward to a kind of movement like that must be ready for all sorts of things. Obviously, very rewarding things, because it's a position that allows you to be creative, allows you to, you know, work with different people and learn from all of them, and also, you know, create bonds with the community as a whole. But at the same time, you have to be tough, you know, firm, I would say, because if you're not like that, it's chaotic, you know. So organizational skills, I would say, are crucial. So if you think you've got the what it takes to be a school leader, well, you should go for it, obviously.
Right, of course. So a lot depends on having the right attitude as well as having the right qualifications and the desire to do that.
Exactly, obviously. Some people might want to give it a try, and then after a year or two, they notice that they are not made for that, because it's, you know, it goes beyond what you can imagine. It goes beyond in the sense that all sorts of problems come up. And then, for instance, the pandemic, nobody was ready for that. And then at one point I was, and I'm sure that your audience, being an audience of educators, must have gone through that as well and will understand what I say. But at one point I had the feeling that I was working at a hospital, Graham. It wasn't a school any longer. I had to pick up the phone and talk to parents who were telling me, well, my son is running a temperature today. Should I send him to school? Should I not send him to school? And I would be all the time advising parents to take the kid to the hospital to do this and that. It was really madness, you know. So and at the same time, of course, you couldn't neglect the curriculum and the work, the everyday work that you had to do as a school leader, obviously. So,
of course.
And take so important decisions, yes.
Mm-hmm. But you, Gabby, you at least had experience of remote teaching when this happened. Did that help you? I imagine it did.
Yes, Graham. I'm so grateful to have had something to do with, well, in this case, I guess I can mention the program I was involved in, right? Say Valen Inglés, which is amazing, this program in Uruguay. And that was what brought us together to work as a team, let's say. And yes, my experience was crucial, because you know, I've always been interested in sustainability, which I think we will discuss later. But in this case, I had the chance to sort of build something, let's say, from scratch, in the sense that there hadn't been many other instances in which people had tried remote teaching before, or not at such a large scale. So when we began and we formed this wonderful team of tutors and, you know, helping and giving support in Uruguay, it was like I learned so many things, and I had to do some research as well, because obviously I had a sort of, you know, I wouldn't say that I had the skills that I needed, because obviously I built the skills as the program progressed, but I had to find applications. I had to see what was best for the teachers. I had to design courses, and you know, it was so much that I did there that, and with, you know, I enjoyed it so much that I had this as a, you know, a bag full of tools that were wonderful when the pandemic came, because obviously I resorted to all the experience I had gathered with this program in Uruguay. So it was amazing. It was amazing. It helps me a lot. And I would say the school relied on that, obviously a lot, and they were very thankful too, because you had to solve things overnight. So,
of course. Mm-hmm. And did you end up training a lot of the other teachers in to help them with remote teaching?
Yes, not only the
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
The English staff, which was the group that obviously it was my responsibility. I had to help the Spanish teachers, the kindergarten head as well, because obviously they hadn't had that experience that we were discussing before. And there were some techie teachers and some others who were not really into technology at all. Obviously, at that point, everybody had an email account and everybody used a phone, you know. In that respect, we were very lucky, but they were not familiar with Zoom, for instance, or any kind of tools that implied synchronicity, or maybe the school didn't have at that point any system like Google Classrooms or any other system where we could, upload material for the kids to work on. So we had to build everything from scratch, and I would say that that's why I had to work so much, because everybody relied on me and the teachers of technology, of course. Well, there's someone you know as well that was working with me, and she gave us a huge hand. And the teachers were all very collaborative and supportive. But at the same time, I had to support them because it was too much pressure and too much stress for them. Yeah, especially because everybody was confined at home with the kids around and the husband's working. And, oh, my God. You must remember that as well, I guess.
Oh, yes. It was a sea change for everybody. It was quite something. But it was really valuable having the experience of remote teaching that we both had, I think, definitely. So I'm gonna move on to sustainability in education, which is one of your special interests, Gabby. What do you understand by sustainability when it comes to education? Why is it so important to you?
Okay, that's a great question, and it's really something that we could be discussing for hours, but I'm going to try and be sketchy, let's say, although we do have time, right?
Definitely.
Okay. It all started, one of my passions, apart from teaching, you were asking me about before other passions, and one of them is traveling. You know, I try to travel as much as I can when I'm free. So one of the trips I took in 2017 was to New York, and I visited the United Nations, and to be honest, up to that point, I hadn't heard much. Of course, we all read about the lack of resources and how the Earth was in danger and global warming and this and that. But I had never seriously explored that as a topic and as a crucial thing as in terms of content to include in my curriculum at school, you know? So yeah. When I visited that place, I was really impressed by an exhibition that was there on display with the 17 sustainable goals in the 2030 agenda, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're so familiar with that, but I looked at that and I said, but how come we are not teaching this? How come this is not part of what we are doing at school seriously, you know, not just in passing, but seriously working on this as cross curriculum, curricular content.
Yeah.
And so I brought all the material I tried to get from them in terms of printed brochures and things and, you know, books. I bought books. And when I came back to Argentina, I started studying that, exploring that. It was August because I had been there in July in the winter holidays that we have in Buenos Aires in Argentina. We've got a break different from the UK. When you are in the summer there, we're in winter, so we stop classes for 2 weeks. And that's when I went there. When I came back, I took that half year to study the subject and to explore. And when we resumed classes in February next year, 2018, I, in the first teachers meeting, the coordination meeting before starting classes, I presented this as a goal for the school as a whole in English. And I thought, well, this is going to be our main goal this year, to include every single aspect of sustainability in our classes, in science, in drama, in storytelling, in English, as when they teach language, you know?
Yeah.
The teachers were amazing, you know? That was a great team of teachers because they jumped at the chance of doing this immediately and they said, of course, this is great. And they started collaborating and bringing ideas and creating projects and you know, from one day to the next, everybody was doing something. Of course, there has to be someone controlling the whole stuff because you cannot teach in first year kids who are only 6 years old. For instance, I don't know, content that has to do with one of the goals related to business and how, you know, business should be sustainable, but you can reduce everything to simple words and simple ideas for the little kids and start with saving water, for instance, right?
And yeah, of course.
So we started working on that, and it's been amazing since then, even though I'm not the head of the school any longer. I was told, because I'm still a kind of, you know, part of the board in terms of offering my advice when they need it. So I'm still in touch with them, and I'm always told about the projects that continue to be alive and kicking. And one of them is sustainability, thankfully. And they are still working on that. But I worked on that from 2018 until I left the position in 2021. And they are
and
still.
How did you first approach this? If someone else wanted to look into sustainability and education in their own school, how would you suggest they first start?
I would say that obviously, first of all, you have to prepare yourself to see, you know, first of all, the age of the kids is crucial, whether it is little kids, young learners, middle school kids or teenagers, you know. For instance, for teenagers, just to give you an example, I still teach teenagers because I prepare groups of people for international exams. And I also help some of them to, you know, apply to universities abroad. So I'm still in touch with them. And what I do is I get speakers to come and talk to them about sustainable projects, or the last one who came to talk to them was a sociologist who told them about the importance of images and how images in any kind of social media or any kind of, you know, publicity affect people in terms of gender equality, for instance, which is another goal, sustainable goal. Well, you can do lots of things if you want to. So I would say that if people are interested, not only interested, but also responsible for this, because I guess that leaders, school leaders and teachers should all include this content at schools. You cannot really turn a blind eye to this anymore because the situation is you know, serious. So that is one of the aspects that is crucial, according to, you know, in my view, let's say, to include sustainability at school as a subject, let's say, in all the different areas. But at the same time, there's another point of view connected with sustainability, which has to do with one of the goals, which is number three. Number three is about well-being and health, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this is valid for all kinds of working environments, but especially in education. You have to look after the well-being of the teachers, the well-being of the group you're working with, the well-being of the, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to be friends with everyone or, you know, be close to everyone or emotionally involved with everyone. But what you really need to do is, especially as a school leader, look after the way people feel. Look after the, be very attentive to their needs, you know, and to whether their needs are satisfied or not, whether you can cater for what they need in terms of, you know, every single detail of their job has to be, let's say, at least satisfactory for them and give them some room for, you know, creativity and agency and promotion sometimes, if possible, freedom. So sustainability in that respect is something that has to be, you know, one of the most important prioritized objectives in any school environment or projects or educational mm-hmm. project. I don't know how you see this, Graham, because you're also involved in projects that, you know, affect people's lives positively, let's say. So
I think it's a great thing to do, but you're the first person I think I know who's sort of talked or made me aware of it being something that's been undertaken in a whole school. I'm sure there are other schools in different parts of the world that are doing it, but you're the first person that's talked to me about it.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that on the one hand, but on the other hand, I wish more schools were doing this. I guess that more and more schools are doing this.
I'm sure they are. It's just yes, I haven't heard about them.
Yes, of course, yes.
Do you know of other schools or the teachers who are involved in this as well?
I know other schools, yes. I know at least one school where there's someone who's a friend of mine and a colleague who always posts things in connection with sustainability. And of course, well, I'm not aware of other schools in detail, let's say, but I'm sure that more and more people are talking about this and doing projects in connection with this. And when I attend, you know, our teacher association meetings like APIVA, which is the one in Buenos Aires, or FAPI, mm-hmm. the one for the whole country, I always get to see projects presented by teachers in connection with this. I guess that more and more people are doing this. Obviously, back in 2018, when I started, it was hardly heard of. And I think that I don't know, I can consider myself one of the first, let's say, as a school leader who tried to do this, but it was so successful and it's been, you know, very important. I really believe that teaching English or any other language as a foreign language, second language, you know, is not enough. Obviously, we all know that at this point, we all know that it's not a question of teaching the language itself, but the language in context, the language in contact with intercultural projects and intercultural awareness and global perspectives, you know, all the things that people are talking about and working on these days. So if language is taught for as a means to get a goal, as a means to, you know, apply what you know and what you've learned to real life, obviously people are more motivated and you know, it makes sense. It becomes meaningful. So we all know that. And I guess that the most meaningful way of wanting to learn a language is to also do something positive with it. So one thing is to teach science, you know, Graham, in sixth form, for instance, in sixth year, we teach science because it's part of the school program for a bilingual school, because that's one of the things I also had to do as a school leader, which was before 2012, the school had English as in the afternoon every single day.
Yeah.
Very intense content and very seriously done, but it wasn't officially recognized as a bilingual school, because in fact, most of the schools have that kind of, let's say, extracurricular English periods at school, right?
Yeah.
So if that happens, teachers do not receive the kind of rights that they receive when they are part of the, what we call here, the planta oficial, which is the official group of teachers with the same category as the Spanish teachers, right? So what I had to do was to design with the head, the general head of the school and the other members of the board, design a bilingual program to submit to the Ministry of Education, and they had to obviously approve of it. And for that reason, we had to add, let's say, more periods of science or periods of literature, you know, more so that in a way you sort of showed them that you were covering not only language, but also special subjects, right?
Right, so, and taught in English, of course.
Obviously, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So they ask you to, you know, include a number of periods of special subjects. Some of them, well, one of them is science. So if you teach science in sixth year, let's say, which is sixth year, with kids who are 10 or 11 years old, and you teach them sustainability, and you teach them, like the teachers who were working with me at that point in sixth year, they were great at projects like growing plants at school, growing a kind of farm at school, making compost, you know. And while they taught the subject itself, they also taught values and knowledge and skills that are good for life, you know, and for a sustainable life. So it was so much more meaningful for the kids, you know, and I'm sure that they will never forget that experience, because it was hands-on experience. And so the language was a means for an end, you know, and it was great in that respect.
And how about the kids and maybe the parents as well? Did they embrace this change when they were doing science in English, etc., or was it a difficult thing to introduce at the beginning?
Well, at the beginning, I would say that it wasn't such a change, because the school was already working with these subjects, although maybe not with so many words on it or in such an organized way, because it was sort of, we had the freedom to choose how many hours and this and that before the bilingual plan, right? Now with the bilingual program, you have to teach so many hours a week of each of the subjects and this and that. So the change was gradual, I would say. It only changed in terms of For instance, the certificate you give the students when they finish primary school says this is a bilingual primary education, let's say. Before, it didn't say that. So the changes were not that big, but in terms of sustainability, the kids not only embraced it, but also became agents in the community. You know, the other day I came across a teacher on the street, and she's one of the young learners teachers, and he told me, "Oh, Gabby, you won't believe this, but the other day I was telling a story," because I also introduced storytelling as a subject at school, and she's in charge of that, and she was telling a story connected with saving water and saving the resources and being responsible with electricity and water and this and that. And she said, and one of the little girls started crying, and she was in tears telling me, "My mom takes too much time washing my hair, and I won't persuade her. I can't persuade her that she has to wash my hair in a shorter time." So you see that they are, I don't know, taking responsibility for what they do at home as well. So that's great.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yes.
And how important is it to get the parents involved and working with the school when it comes to sustainability?
Well, it's crucial. It's crucial, of course. For instance, in the past, you know, we used to give lots of photocopies to the kids. You know, everybody was used to copying, you know, the tests, printing everything. And, you know, we're also trying to save paper. So from one year to the next, the goal is to reduce the number of paper sheets and for instance, documents that we send the parents. And so everything moved on to the virtual environment, and the notifications, for instance, are sent via email or in the school webpage, you know. So parents obviously support that, because now everybody is aware of the need to save resources and to become, you know, more economical in terms of the waste of paper, for instance, which is crucial in a school, you know, because if you really come to think about the kind of printing paper that you wasted throughout the years, you can't believe it. Now we're all more aware of the fact that we need to recycle paper. So there are also projects to recycle paper, or to, for instance, here in Argentina, there's a very nice community project that it's called Bottles of Love. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I haven't. What is that all about?
Okay, that is something you can also do at home there and start the project in Mexico. Bottles of Love means that every home, every school, every classroom can save the waters of the bottles of water, the bottles of, you know, detergent, any kind of plastic bottle that you have, in which, I don't know, you've got things of everyday use. Instead of throwing them away, which you can, of course, throw them away in a recycled bag so that they are being recycled later on. Instead of doing that, what you do is you fill them up very tightly with all the with all the wrappings of anything that, you know, sweets, mints, any kind of plastic paper that comes with food, for instance, at supermarkets. You save all that and you put it inside the bottle. And when the bottle is up to the brim with plastic paper, let's say about plastic wrappings, you take them to special places where they are collected. And then there's an organization that builds furniture, walls, houses out of that kind of material, which they recycle into something hard and sustainable. So we are teaching the kids to do that, and we are having bottles in the classroom and also at home. If you come home one day, Graham, you'll see lots of them in my recycling corner in the kitchen, because I save every single paper that's made of plastic, you know. And I put that in the bottle, and so that's a project that involves kids from kinder to seventh grade at school.
Wow. Well, one thing I saw the last time I was in Uruguay is, as you know, all of the laptops that are given to the children and teachers in that country, they are recycled, and the plastic in the laptops, they take them and turn them into things such as tables and chairs. And you see that around the place when you go there as well, which is fascinating to see these multicolored tables and chairs that are all, that were made from the plastic taken from the old laptops, which is wonderful.
Amazing. Obviously, yes, amazing. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you asked me before if I had some tips for teachers that might be listening to this show and thinking or wondering how to include all that at school. Well, the site, the website of the UNESCO, you know, the website can be in Spanish or English, and I don't know about other language, but I'm afraid there might be translation into other languages as well.
Sure.
It has plenty of resources, amazing resources for all ages to work on the goals. And, you know, from comics to animations to, you know, more serious texts for older kids, maybe videos and projects. There are so many things that you can't possibly cover them all, but you have to browse the site and see what is useful and what you can apply at your own school, depending on the hours of contact you've got with the kids and the age of the kids as well. I don't know the resources you have, but there are so many things that I really recommend, that I highly recommend this, the website, for teachers who are interested in this sustainability sort of approach to education.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And you hinted at it beforehand, Gabby, but CPD, continuing professional development, is a very important thing for you. It's another thing you're entirely committed to personally, as we've been hearing how you continue to study all the time. But how important is it for teachers in general to develop professionally on a continuing basis, do you think?
Okay, well, here I have to be very, let's say, realistic, Graham, because especially in my country, the economic situation is really harsh these days. And teachers are working in the morning, afternoon, and sometimes evening as well, apart from having to take care of their own kids at home. So there's no time. There's no time, honestly. And, you know, unfortunately, CPD is not something that all schools can afford, and they cannot offer the teachers as much training as they should, because it's not officially established that schools should do that. So there are some schools that do that, some others don't, simply don't. So all the, you know, the programs or the courses or the whatever you have to put your name down for, and it's something personal, and sometimes you have to afford that yourself. There are many, many opportunities, luckily, but you need time, and being realistic, I would say that teachers are not given enough time for that. So as a school leader, I think that that's another way in which you have to become responsible for your staff. For instance, one idea that I always share with other school leaders, because everybody complains that there's no time to get all the teachers together for coordination meetings, let's say. So it is true, because all the teachers, you know, are working at the same time simultaneously. So how can you get together, for instance, all the teachers in third with all the teachers in fourth, so that they can, in my case, there were six people, right? Three ABC, three for third, three for fourth. So how can you find the time to get them together to, you know, it's crucial to see what the kids in third do so that the teachers in fourth know how they receive the kids, or if there's any gap in the content they covered, they should coordinate what they do, you know? So yeah. What I did is something that maybe it helps other teachers, if I say it here, which is I asked the gym department to get the kids of third and fourth together at the same time, let's say, you see, for one period only. So obviously that period, they will be packed with kids because there are lots of kids together. But if you've got the space at school, you can do it. And then it was good for them because the next period, they would be free. So instead of having, for instance, Monday first period, third form, and Monday second period, fourth form, they would have all third and fourth in the first period, and then they would be free in the second period. So when they have all the kids of third in the first period together, I would be meeting the teachers, you see, all of them, the six of them. So right. It was a good way of coming to an agreement, let's say, and finding the time to get the teachers together to coordinate the projects, which is crucial. And so, as you were asking me about CPD, obviously it doesn't compare to doing a course or going somewhere to study. But in those meetings, I tried to discuss with the teachers something relevant to them. For instance, when I introduced sustainability, the first year it was important to talk about that. Another project that we embarked on was phonics, you know, for the little kids and how to teach them. So we had people coming to school to train the teachers. And then afterwards, we had to discuss how to apply that and how to teach the sounds in the order in which they had to be taught, and how to make progress from kinder to first and then to second, like that. So it is really important to find the time within the school hours if you cannot really afford to pay teachers courses outside the school hours. Inside the school, you have to organize as much as possible, let's say, moments in which teachers can get trained or can at least have access to material, you know. And for that, as a school leader, you have to do the job first, the research and the job, and find out what they need, you know, and cater for that.
Yes, of course. No, it's very difficult. I think, as you explained, in a lot of contexts and circumstances for teachers, because they are so busy and they're forced to work a lot more maybe than they want to or should do, to find the time to develop, to become better teachers. But it's such an important thing to do, isn't it? As you well know, you and I well know, to be able to do that, because things, I mean, I think it's not only because things are in a lot of areas of education are changing. So being able to keep up with current knowledge and trends and ways of doing things, then there's technology as well. But it's also just, it's a way of keeping interest in the profession as well, isn't it? If you are actively looking and learning yourself, then you tend, I think, to be more interested in what you do as a teacher. Fair to say, do you think?
Absolutely fair and totally true. And you mentioned, for instance, something that is crucial these days, because it didn't happen 30 years ago, let's say, when I started teaching. Now everything changes, you know, so fast that the minute you think you have grasped, for instance, I don't know, artificial intelligence and the tools that we can apply at school and how to discuss this with the kids and how to introduce this without getting into, you know, the easy way of learning, obviously, or cheating or whatever is a matter of concern these days. Before you get to, you know, start doing that, there's a change and this becomes old again and it's, you know, replaced by something more sophisticated. So It's really such a fast pace that it's very hard to keep up with it, but you have to. There's no way out. I mean, we have to be open to everything and read and listen to people who know about that. And, you know, I'm all the time trying to follow people on LinkedIn or Twitter who publish things and post things and papers and, you know, and then try that yourself and embrace what serves the purpose at your school or in your institution or with your group. And leave out the rest, because obviously one thing that can be very frustrating, Graham, I think you must have experienced this yourself also, mm-hmm. is to feel that you cannot, you know, be updated all the time. It's impossible. It's impossible. So we have to be realistic. We do what we can. We cannot really put so much stress on us. And obviously be responsible enough to say, okay, everybody's talking about artificial intelligence. I need to know what this is. I need to explore it. I need to do my research. You know, I cannot really say, well, that's not for me. I'm against it. I don't agree with the use of the tools, because it's a fact that you will get a student bringing an essay written by ChatGPT. So
exactly.
Obviously, you have to know how to react to that and what to do with this. You know, and it's hard because there's a lot going on and we have to be, you know, like open to everything, but it's impossible because we don't have the time we need. But, you know, it's always the golden means of Aristotle, like try to find the balance between the extremes and you know, do our best.
Well, what you said about artificial intelligence is a symptom of just how quickly things change. I don't think it's possible for anyone, not even someone who's spending all of their time all day, all week, to actually keep up with the changes that are happening. It's fascinating, but again, it can be very overwhelming, can't it? I think that's the thing when it comes to new technology, but particular AI at the moment. There's so much happening that it's difficult to know where to start and how to keep up with it, if you like. Do you find that teachers that you know get frustrated by the pace of change these days?
Well, I guess it has to do with age. It has to do with interests. It has to do with how much they have to do apart from school, apart from their job, you know. And there are those teachers who will come with the news of the latest technology before you have even heard of it. And they tell you, look what I found. And these are the people who are all the time looking for something new, and they love it. And they are passionate about it. And the others who, what is that? No, I'm not thinking of using that tool. You know, people who are reluctant to you know, apply that kind of stuff. I have the feeling particularly that, you know, personally, that there's too much perhaps. So students at one point, if you ask them at one point, at least teenagers tell you, no, we don't want to use a computer. We want to have a book. We don't want to see content on the screen. We want to talk. You know, I will tell you something that happened at the MIT. Remember, Graham, when I went to the MIT to speak about Plan Saival?
I do remember that, yes.
Okay, well, that was in 2016. And apart from doing my own presentation, I attended other, you know, meetings and presentations from other people. And at once there was a sort of board of students who got together, and there was someone, students from the MIT, advanced students in technology, you know, the subjects they deal with at the MIT.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the questions they were asked was whether they were happy with the amount of technology that was part of their everyday classes and programs. And all of them, there were about 6 or 7 students, and all of them said, we really want to prioritize contact with the teachers, bonds with the teachers, relationships with the teachers. We are fed up with emails and platforms and, you know, virtual work, let's say. We want to be in the classroom with the teachers in person. We really feel that we are a little bit fed up with technology. And they were at the MIT, you know, imagine.
Right. Interesting. So,
yes, that was really very interesting because, you know, it's one sometimes might think, oh, my school doesn't have enough technology, or I don't have the resources I need, which is, of course, necessary, crucial to have it. But at the same time, I guess there has to be a balance, you know, and there has to be, you know, books that have to be, you know, printed material for
oh, yeah.
I heard the other day, I don't know if you read yeah. something about this, that in Finland, if I'm not wrong, it was Finland, and I must have read this 2 or 3 days ago, the Board of Educators decided to start using books again in the classrooms, because apparently everything has been done on computers lately, and they wanted to experience something with books because they found out that the reading strategies were, you know, not being so good as they thought they might be or they should be.
Well, so, I think there's been some research published about the seeing whether students actually take in more if they read on paper-based books or digital. And it tends to show that at least the research that the retainment is better with paper-based books. Now, I don't know. I like to look at that a little bit critically and think, well, there are some things about the study that I wasn't sure about, that are not clear. For instance, the way that it's been approached. I won't go into the details because we haven't got time, but it's interesting to look at it, I think, with a critical eye. But it's certainly something I think that if students are anyway getting most of their input through screens, then perhaps it's a value in the school to introduce students to alternatives. They should definitely understand and be exposed to other ways of doing things. It shouldn't all be mediated by through screen, should it? I mean, imagine if they're using screens at home, which I'm sure they are these days, and at school, then that's the only kind of world, if you like, of information that they know, which it's interesting to kind of have them introduced to other things as well, I think.
Of course. It's always like that in life in general, you know, find the balance between the things that you do and don't overdo some of the things.
It's funny how years ago I found most of my time talking to teachers, persuading them to do the opposite, because it felt as if teachers were ignoring computers and then mobiles. Mobiles were being banned. It seemed like a lot of teachers, not everyone, of course, as you well know, but a lot of teachers seemed a little bit disconnected from the real world. And it seemed like there was a definite need to introduce information through screens and to have that sort of literacy available, the digital literacy, as part of the school and the classroom experience. And now I find myself wondering whether or not that's a good thing in some cases. Certainly shouldn't be something that is done all the time.
Yes, that's true. And I guess that you and I are sort of going, like taking the lead sometimes in projects. Well, this was the chance in our lives to lead projects maybe where technology was a very important value and was the only means by which we could do our job, let's say. But if you don't have that opportunity and you go on teaching as you used to teach, I don't know, 30 years ago, and the classroom hasn't changed at all, there's something wrong with you, obviously. So as you said, you have to be computer literate and also train students to be, you know, to, unfortunately, there's such a huge gap between the kids who have access to technology and those who cannot really, you know, use that on a daily basis, at least at school, right? They might have a phone, but maybe they are not trained to do projects or to work collaboratively at schools through technology. And there's a huge gap between groups of kids who have access and those who don't. But as teachers, I guess that, as you said, we have to also keep the balance between how much technology we introduce and how much technology we leave out. You know, there are times at school where you have to, you know, allow the students to use a phone because basically you need it for projects or for communication or for, you know, sharing things. And then some other times when you have to ask the students put the phones away or turn them off altogether, and we're going to focus on something different, right? Because yeah. If not, it's rather chaotic. And we don't know what will happen in the future. And you know that when there's a transition and things change from one day to the next and at such a fast pace, as we said before, we need some time to look back and see what is good and what hasn't been that good. But, well, we all know that, for instance, artificial intelligence is here to stay, and we have to see how to include that, when to embrace it and when to leave it out and when to allow it and when not to allow it, you know. But yeah. I'm using that myself, to be honest, to save time, a lot of time. It's amazing, you know.
I think it's the case with most teachers who have started using it. They realize that it can be used to save time, but then you have to be very careful with that, because there are certain things you can do as a teacher to save time that could be opening you up to making lots of errors. And I kind of wonder also at a future where if we have students using AI tools such as ChatGPT to write answers to assessments, we have teachers using ChatGPT to make the assessments and to mark the assessments, then we're strangely enough in a situation where no human being is actually reading or writing anything. It's all being done by the machines.
Oh, terrible. That's so dangerous. I hate that.
It is.
It's a bleak future. No, we cannot think.
So I think that's why I think it's very necessary to have a really, to look at these tools critically and, you know, be careful about what you're using them for. For example, you were talking about language teachers is one thing, I think, because it lends itself because they produce language very well for that kind of thing. And, you know, these tools like ChatGPT now can be used as language conversation partners, which I think is fascinating. But if it comes to teachers using tools such as ChatGPT, for example, to create lesson plans around subjects, there's a lot of, you know, you've heard of it, I'm sure, hallucination going on with these tools. They make things up. They say things that they look like they're fact or they look like they're right, but actually there's a lot of opportunities for them to create things that are not actually true. So I wonder, and I hope it's not the case that a lot of teachers who are teaching subjects are using these tools to actually create content that they're putting in front of putting in front of students as facts, because a lot of these things could be completely false.
Completely false and misleading. And
I'm worried about that, for example.
I remember when Argentina was about to play the final in the World Cup, I asked ChatGPT on purpose, who won the 2022? Now I forgot the time.
22, I think.
22, but, 22.
Yes, I could be wrong.
I can't believe that such a long time ago. Well, okay, who won the championship? And you can't believe the amount of, you know, hallucination and the kind of answers it produced, but because obviously the ChatGPT, open ChatGPT, was trained up to 2020, I guess, and there's nothing for that. So all the things that you asked about that, about after that, it's just pure making it up, you know? So,
yeah, I think that's why it's so important to help students with digital literacy, to look at information critically and help them understand how they can fact check, and what they see on the internet they can't automatically take as being the truth, which I think this is something you do need to help students with, to help them and to teach them to be able to look at things with a very critical eye. And it's a teacher's role, I think, to do that.
Absolutely. We all know that technology is fine as long as there's a teacher who organizes all the information that students bring to the classroom, right? Otherwise, it's chaos. It's something that doesn't make any sense. And obviously, for instance, one good way of looking at the writing pieces with a critical eye is register, for instance, right? Sometimes you can work with students who have a more advanced level of English and ask ChatGPT on the screen in front of all the students to write an essay, let's say, on a certain topic. And then the text that is produced may be inconsistent in terms of the register, you see. You find things that are mixed up between formality and informality, and then there's something students have to be aware of, especially if they're sitting international exams. And you can work with them and say, well, okay, now how would you make this more formal or more informal, or just more, let's say, coherent according to the target reader, you know? Well, many, many things you can do which are good for them and good for you as a teacher as well. And of course, we have to work on that because it exists and it's here and it's all pervading, let's say. But I'm afraid that we have to be tactful and we have to be careful, and we have to. That's why this overwhelming feeling of teachers who cannot keep up with the pace at which things are changing. You have to calm them down and tell them, okay, take it easy. A little bit of this is fine. Take your time. You don't need to use everything all the time to be, you know, the most modern teacher on earth. On the contrary, students really appreciate some other kind of stuff as well. And, you know, just introduce some kind of, peaceful mind inside the classroom that doesn't have to comply with all the pressure from the outside world.
Yeah, it's true. I think the role of a teacher is becoming more difficult and more time consuming, and we're expected to know a lot more than teachers were expected to know in the past.
Absolutely. You know why? What I would say is important. When the pandemic started, we sort of figured out how to cope with it collaboratively with other teachers. So we created a group of teachers. I can't remember the name we gave it, but it was fun. It was teachers from Uruguay, teachers from Cordoba, from Buenos Aires, you know, and we got together once a week to sort of let off steam, you know, and to also share the practices, share good practices, and share with each other what worked and what didn't work in our own context. And that helped a lot. So I guess that in the case of technology and what we are discussing now, it's also good to always belong to, you know, groups of teachers, communities where you can share your concerns and where you can also learn from other teachers and, you know, hear about other, you know, experiences and the projects that other teachers are carrying out, because I guess that the worst thing that may happen to us these days is to feel isolated and to feel that all the responsibility is on your shoulders. And, you know, it's harder than ever to do things by yourself these days. So getting together with other people and also, you know, simply talk to each other about what is going on at your school or with your job, I think is crucial. And it may help a lot to build stronger teachers, emotionally speaking, and also professionally, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So that's why it's so important also to belong to groups, associations. And in my case, I belong to APIVA, Asociación de Profesores de Inglés, the Buenos Aires, the Teacher Association of Buenos Aires. And in turn, we also belong to the one in the whole country. So, well, now we are having IATEFL coming soon, right?
Exactly.
So all the possibilities that teachers are having to get together and share experiences are fabulous. And well, now if you cannot go yourself there, at least you have the chance to watch the videos afterwards, or, you know, have access thanks to technology. So we have to be really thankful to these little devices that we have.
I think that's important. There's so much access to so much CPD opportunities now that teachers can get for free. It's just a question of finding the time to take advantage of them, I think, as we mentioned before. So listen, Gabby, I'm gonna wind things up now. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thanks for sharing all of your ideas about sustainability and telling us about your secret life as an actress when you were younger as well.
Okay, it's been a pleasure for me too, Graham. And well, I'm looking forward to, I don't know, seeing this somewhere and listening to this. And
definitely
afterwards, because you told me that it's going to be left somewhere for.
Yeah, I will share the link with you, and everyone will have the opportunity to listen to the recording as well as listen to it live on Teachers Talk Radio.
Okay, amazing. Congratulations on having this program, because I guess it's really nice for you to be in touch with teachers from all over the world, and for
people
as well to listen to teachers from educators from different contexts. So
yes, I think it's a great excuse for me, for my own professional development, to have conversations, lengthy conversations, because we've talked for about an hour and 20 minutes with people I know or people I don't know about education, which is not something you normally have the chance to do. So for me, I find it a great opportunity and a privilege and a pleasure to be able to have these conversations and find out more about what people like yourself, how, you know, talking to teachers is always passionate. Teachers are always passionate about what they do, and talking to them, you find out all sorts of interesting things that I wouldn't otherwise find out. So I think it's a great pleasure to do it, but not only to talk to you, but to listen to other teachers talking, which is what this channel is all about. There's lots of other sort of hosts and a lot of other guests. So I recommend you listen to some of them, definitely, Gabby.
Yes, I will, of course. And you've been a great host with great questions. Oh, so
thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Well, so that brings us to the end of today's Twilight Show. Many thanks to today's special guest, Gabriella Madeira, and all of you who joined us live. In particular, Evelyn, who I was chatting with in the studio while the show was on. And Evelyn is very interesting. It was very interesting to talk to her because she's a substitute at 11 different schools. And four of them are high schools. And she was chatting a little bit about how difficult that was. And I'm trying to persuade her to come on the show because I think talking to a substitute teacher like Evelyn would be a really interesting thing to find out exactly what she does. All the students, she says they want to just play games. They don't listen to her. And there have been fights with students. So it's very rough. To be a sub where she's from, and that's in Alabama in state schools. So I would like to talk to you, Evelyn, if you're still listening. It would be great. Please drop me a line, as I suggested. And Evelyn was also talking about having to all of the workload that she has, apart from the outside of the classes she has to do, webinars to attend, tests and certificates to get on various things that the schools ask for. And so it would be really interesting to talk to you. So that is it from me. There are Teachers Talk radio shows all week on all manner of different and interesting topics. So please listen in live or to the recordings. And I hope you will join me again next week at the same time. Bye for now.